This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. These days, you can use your face to unlock a phone. Facial recognition technology is being used by Customs and Border Protection at some airports for arriving and departing passengers, including in Orlando. And now the Orlando Police Department is trialling real-time facial recognition technology. The police department says that technology could improve safety and security, but civil liberties groups are calling time out. They say it's too soon to roll out this technology. So what do you say? What freedoms are you willing to give up for safer streets? Do you worry about the proliferation of this kind of surveillance, or are you embracing the technology? We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. You can send in your comments and questions on Twitter too. We're at WMFE Orlando. And joining us is Deputy Chief Mark Canty. He's with the Administrative Services Bureau of the Orlando Police Department. Deputy Chief Canty, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
I'm also joined by Claire Garvey. She's with the Georgetown Laws Center for Privacy and Security. Claire, thank you for joining us too.
Thank you for having me.
And Roger Rodriguez is Director of Client Relations at Vigilant Solutions. It's a company that provides facial recognition and number plate recognition technology programs to law enforcement. Roger, thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you, sir, for having me on the show.
Chief Candy, I want to start with, or Deputy Chief Candy, rather, I want to start with you. Who approached whom, can you tell me, for setting up this trial? Did Orlando Police reach out to Amazon? Did Amazon reach out to the police department?
No, Amazon reached out to our information technology section to the city of Orlando and the police department. So they sought us out for some of the initiatives that the city's already doing as far as smart cities.
Okay. And the trial has been running for some time, right? Like, started back in December. What have you learned so far?
Well, we did start back in December. It hasn't been it's kind of a proof of concept, so we haven't had the success that we wanted, but because we have a bunch of different cameras, so we're just trying to see if the technology works. We think it is very promising technology, so we would like to try to continue to explore it and see if we can get it to help us improve public safety.
Can you clarify something for me, too? I'm just wondering how many cameras throughout the city are being used in this trial and how many of them are actually on the streets, because I understand there's a blend. You know, some of them might be like within the police department, others are actually out, you know, on the city streets.
Right now, we're using 8 cameras. 4 of those cameras are at our police headquarters, and then the other 3 are out in the community.
Okay.
I would say the other 4. There's 4 out in the community.
Right. And you've got a bunch of volunteer officers who've said, yeah, we'll help you out and see if this technology does what it's supposed to.
Yes. It's only our sworn police officers. We have 7 of those that are involved in the test project.
Okay. So, essentially, you're saying the trial has to be extended because it isn't quite working the way you thought it would, or the way it was pitched to you.
Well,
or...
we're using our existing technology, so we're using some of our existing cameras. So we have right now we have 3 different models of cameras, and we're trying to make sure that it's going to work with each of those camera systems. So we're trying to be fiscally responsible and not have to purchase a bunch of new equipment. Mm-hmm. We're trying to make sure that it's going to work with all the existing equipment the city currently has.
Is facial recognition technology something that the police department already uses for still images?
We don't use it now. We don't. I know other law enforcement agencies do use it, and I think you see the value in it. I know that helped them identify the shooter up in Maryland. So I think there is definitely a value for it. So.
Mm-hmm. Let me read a little bit of what the ACLU and other groups are worried about. Here's a quote. The software has the potential of being used for discriminatory immigration enforcement, monitoring individuals who attend protests and engage in other nonviolent activities, or disproportionately surveilling minority communities and residents who have committed no crime. End quote. That's from a letter that a number of these organizations sent to Police Chief John Mina. I mean, what can the police department do to make sure that some of those privacy concerns raised by civil liberties groups don't come to pass?
I mean, obviously, if the technology works and we choose to implement something like this, there'll be many discussions, mainly with our legal team is going to be helping. It would be helping us write a policy to determine when we would use this technology, and it wouldn't be a case where we're just monitoring people who haven't committed a crime. We're looking at this technology solely for the purpose of finding violent offenders that have committed violent crime against a resident or a guest in the city of Orlando. Mm-hmm. That's primarily what we're looking at, or it could be a potential threat to a school. So someone who has demonstrated some or made some serious threats to a school or another public gathering, situation we thought might be able to use it is if you had a child that was missing working with the child's parents, you'd be able to get a photo of the child, put it in there, and see if we can track and see where they were and try to locate them. So before we implement it, there's going to be a lot of discussions. Legal is going to be involved. Our primary goal at the police department is going to be, you know, to protect the constitutional rights of all our residents and all our guests, and we're going to follow the law.
If this goes beyond a test, like say you get to the end of this second part of the trial and you're like, okay, it works, would you be using non-criminal databases like driver's license photographs, for example, to make a match?
We haven't talked about that far. I think we would not be tapping directly into driver's license databases just on a regular basis. Like I said, if we were going to use it, the way we're thinking now is we would have a specific suspect that we were looking for or a specific person that we were looking for, and then we would use an image of that person. Mm-hmm. We're not looking to just run this software against any existing databases just to monitor people in the area.
You listen to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Deputy Chief of Police Mark Canty with the Orlando Police Department, talking about the trial of real-time facial recognition software. I want to hear from you too. Do you have concerns? Are you okay with this technology sort of being tried out? Do you have any worries about how it might be used in the future? We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can reach out with your questions and comments on Twitter too, at WMFE Orlando. Claire Garvey, I want to bring you into this conversation. Georgetown Law Center for Privacy and Security produced a report, a study back in 2016. It was titled Perpetual Lineup, Unregulated Police Face Recognition in America. Briefly, what did you find in the study?
We found that the use of face recognition by law enforcement across the country is a lot more advanced and a lot more widespread than most people realize. For example, over half of all American adults are in face recognition databases now that are used by police to conduct criminal investigations, not because they've had prior interaction with the police, but because they have a driver's license. That includes all Florida driver's licenses as well.
Mm-hmm.
We found that the technology does make mistakes. We like to think of the technology as a biometric, so it acts like DNA or fingerprinting. It makes a lot more mistakes, and it makes more mistakes on certain people. Evidence suggests that it makes more mistakes on women, on young people, and on African Americans.
Why is that?
There are a number of theories out there. IBM and Microsoft are right now looking into why their systems might perform less well on African Americans and women specifically, and they have made improvements to their systems, so I think it may have to do with their training data sets. The other thing we found is that by and large, there are no rules. There are no laws governing how police can use these technologies, and there are very few policies. We found that about a quarter of all law enforcement agencies have access to a face recognition system, including over 250 agencies throughout Florida. And by and large, there are very few policies
I'm clear, when you say police departments like that having access to that technology, you're talking about like real-time technology of the sort that the Orlando Police Department is testing out or just using still images?
We're talking about the use of still images. In terms of real-time, we see 6 to 8 major agencies now actively looking into the ability to do real-time face recognition, and every major company that sells the technology to law enforcement agencies advertising the ability to do real-time face recognition.
So the study came out, the report came out in 2016, and technology is kind of moving quite quickly. Has anything changed since then? I mean, if you talk about the regulations, for example, are there some more regulations in place now, 2018, compared to when you guys were reporting and looking into this?
If anything, the technology has become more advanced and more widespread than it was in 2016. There have been some efforts to bring the technology under control. For example, a legislator in Maryland introduced a bill that would regulate the use of the technology. But the reality is today there are still no laws and still very few rules governing how police use it. And the public is still the last to find out that the technology might be used on them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to bring Roger Rodriguez with Vigilant Solutions into this conversation. Vigilant is a company that provides facial recognition and number recognition programs to law enforcement. Just give us a quick précis, if you could, Roger, on the kinds of technology that you guys work on and how it's used by some of your clients.
Certainly. Vigilant provides a seamless online data sharing platform for law enforcement that allows agencies to easily share data for solving cases faster, locating criminals who may be on the run. We have a very, very solid footprint in license plate recognition, and our image analytics are cloud-based. And we have since I've been employed with Vigilant, two additional offerings. Their facial recognition solution and our new ballistic analysis software. So these offerings make up our intelligence-led policing platform. And in essence, they are the right tools for law enforcement, primarily directed and built by law enforcement personnel with a wonderful engineering team and development team. We provide intelligence-led policing solutions for law enforcement, which generate investigative leads.
Is this a good time to be getting into this field? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of potential clients out there.
This is a very, very opportune time to really, really expand on this technology. Law enforcement uses facial recognition for many, many different reasons. Primarily, when I used it in my tenure in New York before I was employed by Vigilant, many agencies primarily use it to ascertain if an individual's identity is an essential element of a crime. As Chief Canty from Orlando expressed, we have to, or law enforcement uses it as part of a bona fide investigation. Now, in recent years, as the technology has improved, it's been used also outside of forensic capacity to ensure officer safety. We do this in lawful custody arrest situations as part of routine identification. Chief Canty mentioned Annapolis and the identification of Jared Ramos. Mm-hmm. We use it to identify potentially fraudulent identification during investigative stops when people do not have or cannot produce any forms of valid ID. So the technology as a whole has gotten better in recent years with matching accuracy. There are limitations, but the deployment is the right time. And it's through forums like these, educating the public, that we can tell them to use the software properly. I do agree with Claire when she mentions laws and policies need to be put in place, and agencies are implementing across the country those policies and regulations on usage. So, yes, it is the right time to deploy.
All right, Roger, what though about the concerns? I mean, Claire mentioned some of the issues with identifying certain kinds of people, like, for example, women, minorities. That seems like a pretty big hurdle to clear for this technology. Should you put the brakes on before some of those things could be sorted out?
In my personal experiences using this technology, and I've used it many, many times for many, many cases, I have not seen any sort of racial disparity in the algorithms. I leverage the metadata. The metadata is anything associated with that image. So I am a male Hispanic, but I can also be classified as a male white Hispanic. So I would use the demographic information behind an image as a filter, using that to drive the results down to levels of specificity. That is only going to improve your matching algorithm. It's not going to take anything away from it. There are limitations to the technology, as Claire mentioned, with females. I personally have noticed that females' makeup is one issue. Women wear their hairstyles a certain way that may occlude various parts of the face. Hmm. So these are all limitations that the technology does have, but there are ways to use this technology to still identify people without solely relying on the software. So the end result for law enforcement in every situation is to identify a person, but using facial recognition technology, we use it for investigative purposes primarily. Now, to summarize this very quickly, with the cautions I have about the real-time streaming analytics, is before an actual deployment is done, all the parties involved, the law enforcement, city leaders, legislators, privacy groups, all must have a clear understanding how this technology actually works and move away from the Hollywood glamorization of the technology. It's only through education and platforms like these can everyone fully understand the current limitations. The need for human involvement is always necessary after searches are performed and executed to vet those results. Law enforcement has been doing that for years. The need for policy, accountability, transparency at the agency level must be ensured before, during, and after deployments of these systems. Any agency deploying must have a self-regulating inquiry system, which meets CJIS compliance. Doing so ensures all officers within the community of law enforcement are utilizing this technology properly, and it brings needed integrity to an already unfairly criticized technology.
It's Roger Rodriguez there with Vigilant Solutions, which provides some of those technologies that we're talking about here, facial recognition, license plate recognition as well. Deputy Chief Canty with the Orlando Police Department, I mean, it sounds like there are quite a lot of things that you need to make sure you've got in place. I mean, are we talking about years before this might actually be rolled out in an actual law enforcement situation in Orlando?
I mean, I think it's hard to say what the time frame is going to be. It's going to depend, one, on how the technology is and how useful it is and how it works. I think other things that we will have to talk about and we'll have to discuss is the policy. And I mean, at the Orlando Police Department, we have a history of taking some of our policies to the community and getting their input. Several years ago, we wanted to look at our pursuit policy, and the chief at the time created basically a community commission to come up with some language and some recommendations on what kind of crimes we were going to pursue it. And that was basically done to say, hey, if we're out there chasing a suspect, what are the crimes that the community wants us to chase for? Do you want us to chase for a suspended driver's license? Or do you only want us to chase for violent forcible felonies? And obviously the community said, hey, we want you to chase for the violent forcible felonies. And we altered our policy to reflect that. I think the other thing you have to look at, too, is just because you have the technology or the technology works, it does not replace good common sense and good law enforcement work. Take, for instance, if you had a caller that called in to report a crime and they gave you a description of a suspect, their description is going to be varied and flawed. So the officer doesn't 100% say, hey, they said the person looks exactly like this, so those are the only people they stop. The officer goes to the area, they look and see somebody who may match the description, and then look at their behaviors. And then they don't make an arrest based on that. They go to start conducting an investigation. And if that person turns out not to have done anything, then they're released. If that person turns out to be the person who's committed a crime, then obviously, you know, we try to develop probable cause and make the arrest. So I think we're just at the infancy stages. We're testing the technology. There's going to be a lot more discussions and a lot more things that have to happen before it's actually going to be implemented with the Orlando Police Department.
Claire Garvey, this is all well and good, and obviously these are things that happen in an ideal rollout of this technology, but what about other police departments or other law enforcement agencies that are trying this out? I mean, are you seeing some of those concerns play out in real time? Sometimes decisions are made in a split second, you know, when there's a criminal investigation or something. So how are some of these issues sort of being realized, some of the concerns that people have, and what are law enforcement agencies doing about it?
What we've seen across the country is the public is very much kept in the dark when it comes to face recognition technology. I am highly encouraged about what Deputy Chief Canty is saying about implementing a policy and having community input. The reality is, in many, many police departments that already use this technology, that has not been the case. So the public is not involved in deciding about whether this technology is used and how it's used. I want to go to something that Roger Rodriguez mentioned. I agree that when we talk about face recognition, we're talking about a lot of different things. When we talk about real-time face recognition, what we're really talking about is a system that scans the faces of every man, woman, and child walking by the camera. Yes, it might be looking for specific individuals, but given the fact that face recognition makes mistakes, it means everybody who walks by a camera might be misidentified by that camera. as somebody the police are looking for. That's a very serious concern, and that raises different concerns than a system just used for officer safety or for identification purposes after an arrest.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we just have to think very, very carefully about what we mean when we say face recognition and be honest with ourselves about what this technology really means to the average citizen.
What, we've already heard or seen one facial recognition technology company boss, is Brian Brekeen of Kairos. I think I'm pronouncing the name of the company right there, but he's saying the tech is not ready for use by law enforcement. Here's what he wrote on the website TechCrunch. Clearly, facial recognition-powered government surveillance is an extraordinary invasion of the privacy of all citizens and a slippery slope to losing control of our identities altogether. There's really no nice way to acknowledge these things. I've been pretty clear about the potential dangers associated with current racial biases in face recognition and open in my opposition to the use of the technology in law enforcement. End quote. I mean, that sort of goes to some of the concerns that you raised, Claire Garvey. But I'm wondering, what are we hearing from other tech companies? I mean, are they sort of sounding the alarm a little bit too, or does this just seem like it's a business opportunity, and obviously law enforcement is calling for this kind of technology to deploy because it makes their job easier?
I mean, we also, in addition to what Brian Brekeen has said, we see employees at Amazon asking the company to be careful about what this technology is used for. They don't want to be making tools that are used to target people unfairly. We see IBM and Microsoft changing their practices to make sure that their systems don't make mistakes that affect certain people more. So we do see companies taking a cautious approach and really looking hard at what technology they're creating and what might be the impacts. And this should tell us just how serious the problem might be when companies who, yes, this is a business opportunity for them, they do want these contracts, are taking a step back and really thinking critically about whether they want this technology used in these ways.
Mm-hmm. Roger Rodriguez with Vigilant Solutions, I want to just come back to you real quick. I mean, you mentioned something about makeup being something that can defeat the camera if you're looking at real-time facial recognition software. What about people deliberately trying to cheat it, like using a mask or some kind of urban camouflage to sort of break up the outline of their face? Is that a concern as well?
So sure, I mean, you absolutely need to see definitive facial definition at some point for a face recognition system to work. Now, as far as the real-time streaming analytics, you know, Claire had mentioned that everybody is captured and cataloged, and there's a potential for everybody to be misidentified. And this is a perfect example. And it's not, you know, I'm not going to go tit for tat here.
Mm-hmm.
This is a perfect example on how this is misinformation. It basically, I will say that law enforcement does not use facial recognition for pervasive surveillance at public gatherings. When cameras with built-in facial recognition are deployed, they're primarily used to identify select individuals in the form of defined alerts. And I think Chief Canty spoke about that, right? He has
sure.
His officers out there testing the system on specific individuals. These alerts are then targeted by the agency, and the faces that make up these specific alert databases are comprised of mugshots, wanted persons, and banned individuals. So the message that needs to be conveyed to the public and the general population as a whole is that their faces are not being cataloged or tracked by government agencies. We do not have the storage capacity for that.
Right.
This may be occurring in other countries, but, you know, it's important to understand that these regions are not free democratic societies like the United States.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Every citizen in the United States deserves to live peaceably, and law enforcement has responsibility to use technology to protect in these efforts. So the message that needs to resonate is to focus on the positive use cases of this technology and not hypothetical.
Roger Rodriguez, we are going to have to leave it there, but I do want to thank you for joining us. As with Vigilant Solutions, it's a company that provides facial recognition and number plate recognition programs to law enforcement. We're also joined by Deputy Chief of Police with the Orlando Police, Mark Canty, and by Claire Garvey with Georgetown Law. Thank you all so much for joining us. Coming up next, the situation in San Juan, Puerto Rico, 10 months after Maria Howe's life on that island. Intersection is getting back to you in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Wilton Vargas is the editor of the technology website Technetico.com. He lives in Puerto Rico, and this time 10 months ago, he was hunkered down in San Juan as Hurricane Maria pummeled the island. Wilton, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what's life like for you? Just give us a snapshot of daily life on the island.
If you stay in the metro area, you'll think that everything has returned to normal and, you know, everything is okay and, you know, we're back to our old selves. But it's far from normal if you go beyond the surface, if you look deep, and you'll see that, let me give you an example, labor shortages. A lot of people has left. There's a lot to do in terms of reconstruction, and there's not enough people to do it. So there's a shortage of labor for the most basic things. I mean, either if it's something for, you know, to fix something on your home, or if it's a building that needs a renovation, you can wait. You're going to have to wait for months in order for anyone to be available for you to hire. So it is one of those things that you don't see, but if you ask around, if you look hard enough, then you'll find that this is not normal yet. And the fear of, you know, whenever a small rain comes, that the power is going to go out, it's something that is just part of our normal daily life now.
So Hurricane Beryl, a small hurricane, but still packing a bit of a punch, kind of rolled over a few days ago. What was the impact of that storm for you? I gather there were some power shortages and other things as a result of that storm.
There were, I believe, about 50,000 without power. Although I have to say it was for a short amount of time, but it did happen. And this happened with just, you know, some rains. Yes, there was some wind at higher elevations here, but nothing at all compared to what we went through with Maria. And yet still, people were having problems with their electricity, and a lot of people just left anything that they were doing. They put it aside, and they ran to the supermarket and started getting supplies, because they thought that this was going to be, you know, yet another event. But Beryl, I can tell you that it was like a rehearsal for anything that might, you know, come. We hope nothing else comes, at least this year. But it felt like a rehearsal.
So, you know, we're more than a month now into hurricane season 2018. And what's your sense, Wilton Vargas, of how well prepared the island of Puerto Rico is if another big storm were to hit right now?
No, we're not prepared. We are not. I can tell you that much. Why? First, there is no assurance from any governmental agency that they are actually prepared. I mean, one thing is what they might say, but if you look at the way people react, there is no confidence in the government to handle anything that might come our way. So that explains why people reacted the way they reacted when Beryl threatened us. And it's that they have no confidence, and they prefer to take the matter into their own hands and just, you know, based on experience, react and act accordingly. Having said that, it has become an accepted part of living here. And it is very sad, because it reflects not only the local government, but also the federal government. There has been, after all this ordeal, there has been a lack of confidence in our governments. And, you know, that's why I say we're not ready.
I want to ask, too, Wilton, about the death toll from Hurricane Maria. You know, we read about the official death toll from the storm, but then there was this report about the estimate of the actual number of people who died as a result of Hurricane Maria, many of them in the aftermath because of things like the lack of electricity and other issues related to that storm. I'm wondering what the impact was in Puerto Rico when this news broke, and what did that do for your sense of who to trust for information?
Psychologically, it was like when we heard that, it was like we kind of knew, you know, because it was impossible that something like this you know, yield at such a low death toll. The stories we heard from relatives, from friends, you know, me being in the media and listening to people around me talking about what they saw, it was just impossible to just accept that only a little bit short than 70 people died on such a major event. So when we heard about this, I think the collective thought was we kind of knew, because nothing, something like this doesn't, you know, leave any stone unturned. And just imagine all these people living in the deep parts of the island without an adequate home. And yes, there has been a lot of unlawful and unsafe constructions. So just, you know, trying to imagine what the result of a hurricane like this had on such constructions can only drive you to one conclusion, which is that, yes, the official death toll is ridiculously low. It can be, and we got to get to the bottom of this. And I think that's the collective mentality here, that definitely not 60-something. We got to get into the bottom of this to know truly how many people died during Maria and after Maria.
It sounds, too, as though, you know, aside from whatever physical damage to property and other issues, whether it's health issues related to that storm that people are dealing with, there's also some psychological trauma to work through. How are people in Puerto Rico dealing with it and coping with that? And as you were saying, every time there's a storm in the forecast, there's a sense of trepidation from folks on the island there. What's that like?
Well, there's a local meteorologist that she has been the inspiration of so many memes, because, and I think this reflects on our state of mind. So whenever she does a live stream on Facebook, people get like the heebie-jeebies. They get nervous. They get so worked up, because what is she going to say? Are we going to be affected by another hurricane?
What is this meteorologist's name?
Her name is Ada Monzon. And whenever she does a Facebook Live, it's like hysteria, because it's people's reaction on what is she going to say? Are we going to be, is there anything else coming? You know, and it reflects, you know, it may pass as a joke, but I think it deep down, it reflects our state of mental health regarding this, and how even the mention, the thought, the possibility of being hit by another of these things, it'll send people, you know, running and reacting to whatever it is that they have to do in order to you know, to get ready for whatever it is that is coming. So, do we have PTSD as Puerto Ricans? I think we do. And one of the things that I've said to colleagues and people that I love is that, you know, we don't talk about this enough, what we went through, psychologically speaking, our feelings, our emotions, during and after. And the less we do that, the longer we will be reacting this way. And instead of being rational and rational and just, you know, take our precautions, get ready for the start of the hurricane season, no, we will continue just reacting to whatever comes. And if we don't get that taken care of and have our emotions come out and just, you know, let it all out, then I think we're going to be just reacting to stuff instead of responsibly preparing and just accepting it as a part of life, of life living in the Caribbean.
Let me ask you this too, finally, Wilton Vargas. Are you personally prepared as far as whatever you need to do to make sure that you are ready for the next big storm?
No. And I have to be honest with you. I might have, you know, the physical part of it nailed down, but psychologically, it is still something that, you know, I remember speaking to you the morning, that same week of the hurricane, and I remember how the sliding doors in my balcony of my apartment were bending to the will of the wind. And whenever there is a whiff of something that might rattle those sliding doors, I get, you know, I react to it, and I stand up, and it could be during the day or in the middle of the night. I might be sleeping, and I'm still, you know, worked up if I hear something. So that's why I have to be honest with myself, and I hope that anybody that is listening to this, that has gone through something similar, just, you know, take a look inside and see if there's something that you need to talk about and think about regarding this, because this affects people deeply. This affects a person deeply. And in my case, I'm still, you know, dealing with the effects of it.
Well, Wilson Vargas, good luck preparing for whatever comes this hurricane season. Let's hope that it stays quiet in the Caribbean, but best of luck to you, and thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Matthew.
And Wilson Vargas is the editor of Technetico.com, a technology website based in Puerto Rico. Up next, a poet turns to music. Brian Turner and a group of musicians have a new album out. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando-based writer Brian Turner is best known for his poetry. Turner's collections Hear Bullet and Phantom Noise and his memoir My Life as a Foreign Country draw on his experience in the US Army. Turner's newest project is a bit different, though. He assembled a group of musicians, the Interplanetary Acoustic Team, and they're releasing an album titled 1111, Me Smiling. The album includes lyrics by his late wife, the poet Elise Kuznets, who died in 2016. And here's a track from the Interplanetary Acoustic Team's new album. It's called The Tremble of Quantum Strings.
Can you hear me?
I spoke to Brian Turner, along with Ben Kramer, who performs bass, keyboards and theremin, and who engineered the album. Turner began by talking about his inspiration for the project, his wife, poet Elise Kuznets, who taught at Valencia College and was part of Orlando's literary scene.
We married and I moved here to Orlando, and then in 2016 she passed away from cancer. And her second book will be coming out next spring. But after she passed away, I remember I was flying across the country. I was about 30,000 feet up, and it was nighttime, and I was looking out the port window of the plane, and I was thinking about this one poem of hers called Before I'm Downloaded into a Most Excellent Robot Body. And it was this idea of cybernetics and the uploading of consciousness, which she knew wouldn't happen in her lifetime. And a conversation that we had for many years about robots and cybernetics and this type of thing fascinated both of us, and I realized that maybe this was an inroads toward a project where her voice could be shared with many. And that's really what became the genesis of this album.
And you have a lot of recordings of her reciting her poems talking, and that's blended into this work as well, right?
Right. After she passed, that's what I ended up doing. I went through, it's part of the grieving process, is just trying to find and hold on to as much of your loved one as you can, you know. So I went through looking for photographs, but also audio. And she'd been a journalist in Scotland and here at the Sentinel at one point, too. So there were a lot of her text, you know, journalistic dispatches and things, articles she'd written. But on background, she'd talked to these folks, a lot of famous authors, international authors around the world. And I have these little mini micro discs or micro cassettes that have her talking with them. And then also a lot of her readings that she did around the country. So those, along with some audio notes on her phone, created this audio archive that I sort of pulled from just on the specific subject of cybernetics and robots. And so this is just one little tiny slice of that larger conversation.
What do you play?
Nothing very well, but little bits and pieces of this and that. I started as a trumpet player when I was a boy in elementary school in Fresno, California. And then I grew my hair long halfway down my back and switched to bass guitar and played some bass and some punk band by default because we didn't know very many chords.
Was that the name of the band, by default?
We should have been. We were called Los Muertos Muchachos, or the Dead Guys, you know, at the time. And it was a lot of fun playing in that band. And that band, we were a little bit like Spinal Tap. The drummer just kept blowing up or explode. You know, something would happen to the drummer. We just would change drummers and singers. And my best friend and I, that was really a love that we had, was making music and composing ideas and trying to sing.
So in this album, what instruments do we hear you on?
Bass, vocals. There's modular synth, which is a surprise to me, and because I was always very anti-synthesizer until this project, and also some acoustic guitar and electric guitar, and a flugelhorn.
So Ben, tell me about how you came to be involved in the Interplanetary Acoustic team.
Brian and I first met actually through Jared Sylvia, who is a major contributor on this project. Jared and I worked together and introduced me to Brian originally. During the first project that we worked on together, which is not this one, but a previous album, I was just helping Brian bring his ideas to fruition. And soon we just started collaborating more and more. Sometimes as an audio engineer, you're just there to be the hired help and do the technical job. But with Brian, it just became more and more of a collaboration, and I have really enjoyed that part of the process.
Mm-hmm. And you play a bunch of instruments on this too. Tell me about some of the musical contributions you make on the album.
Sure. I play bass on a few of the tracks, and sometimes Brian and I are playing bass on the same track at the same time. So that's one example of something that's a little different on this album.
That's a lot of bass.
It's never enough.
Yeah. It's kind of middle.
There's a few keyboard parts that, you know, I wouldn't call myself a keyboard player, but when the job needs to be done, I'll pull out the keyboard. And there's even theremin on one track, and I've never had a credit playing theremin on an album before, but this is it's a first for me.
Is this the first time you've played theremin, or is it something you're familiar with?
Oh, it is the first time I've ever played theremin. This is actually a theremin that me and my wife Serena built just for fun. And as we were creating the album, we thought it really fit on one of the tracks. So it was just the right thing at the right time.
And just to give our listeners an idea, I mean, theremin is something you might hear from like horror movie soundtracks from somewhere in the middle of the 20th century, right?
That's right. And then they had a little bit of a renaissance in the 60s when the Beach Boys started using it in some of their songs. And it's a nice addition to the album.
Right around the same time, Forbidden Planet came out just before that. And that movie had what's called a Krell patch. And that really, with synthesizers, that's sort of a signature moment in synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
And Jared Sylvia got me into synthesizers. So the modular synthesizer, where you're, you know, creating take a signal and you amplify it and then split it and then shape the waveforms on each of those notes and then create a kind of, on the out, what comes out of the speaker is music, but it's really handcrafted from the very first signal of that music.
Mm-hmm.
So as he started helping me pull me down the rabbit hole of modular synthesis, I started finding about Forbidden Planet and the Krell patch, which is a sort of, it's hard to describe, but it's in a sense to me, it's a gesture towards immortality. It's a type of repetitive pattern that's random. It has randomness built into it.
Mm-hmm.
And that gesture towards the infinite seemed perfect for this album. And that's really what drove me towards modular synthesis. So I ended up getting what's called a No Coast, or it's by Make Noise, and then And working with a little kid synthesizers that have magnets and you put them together. They're called Little Bits by Korg. And that really taught me, just as it would with children, because I'm a child to the instrument,
mm-hmm.
and about some of the fundamental parts of synthesis and sequencing and envelope filters and et cetera, et cetera.
So you had a lot of fun with this.
Absolutely, yeah, because it's a learning process. And I think what it is, you know, I'd played some instruments before and composed songs with friends over the years. But I think sometimes when we have a certain practice, but if we disrupt it by adding a new factor into it, we can evolve and we have to respond to that. So it helps us find a new way into art, if that makes sense.
Do you take the same approach to music that you do to writing poetry?
In this particular case, all of the words are Elisa's words. So she had a different poetic practice. And so I had to sort of listen to what it was that the words were doing and what her intentions were as much as possible. And then Ben and I and Jared and the others, we had to try to find ways to create a sort of landscape of sound so that she could narrate the journey of the album.
Ben, I want to just come back to the theremin for a moment. How do you build a theremin? Are there plans out there?
You know, there's actually an active community of theremin enthusiasts out on the internet. There's, if you're into something, there's usually a group of people on the internet that are also into that same thing. But this was actually a kit that my wife ordered because she was interested in it, and I just thought it was the coolest thing. So that was one of our weekends. We just decided to put together this theremin, and it really sat in the closet for a long time after we had our initial fun with it. And as you know, Brian, the process usually starts with ideas that come out of Brian's head, and one of them just called for a theremin. So I said, I happen to have one of those in the closet. It was just a moment of great collaboration.
Are you performing this album live anywhere?
We did once here in town. We tried it out. It's a little tricky because there's an opera singer who's in Cologne. The Parkinson sisters are in Massachusetts. Sunil Yapa does some amazing guitar work on the album. He's in Montreal. So they're cast to the winds, you know, and how do we assemble the interplanetary acoustic team enough to do this? But Jared, Sylvia, and Ben worked together with some of the files to create like a skeleton of the song. And then we recently played, and Ben played bass, and I did some flugelhorn and sang and recited some of Elise's poems in it. We found variations of the songs that we could perform live. It was fun.
Now, this is coming out on the 13th, right?
That's the anniversary of Elise's birthday.
Brian, do you have any standout tracks off of this album?
We do. Light Sketch is one that features her voice, of course, but it also has an unusual thing where I contacted Elise's friends and, you know, best friends and her brothers, for example. I think they're about 12 people, and there's binary code that's sort of mentioned in the album. So I asked them to record ones and zeros. And then we sort of scattered their voices in the acoustic field. So there's this binary chorus of ones and zeros of people who love Elise that are in the background of that song.
How would you describe this music, Ben?
That's a great question. It's a really an eclectic mix. It's unlike anything I've worked on before. Just like Brian was just saying, a typical session would include Brian coming and saying, here are a lot of audio recordings of people saying one and zero, let's make a binary chorus. So there's a lot of unusual elements, but at its core, it's synthesizer and electric elements mixed with analog instruments like performing bass live and keyboards, and then Elise's beautiful words.
And Brian, this isn't the end of this particular musical collaboration, right? You have some other plans.
I do, and most of that's just because I love working with Ben. You know, the main reason is just I feel like it's a really great collaboration, and he's able to sort of translate my thinking, and I feel like oftentimes, and then his contributions, the way we work together, isn't the thing that I thought in my head, but it's better, you know, and I enjoy doing that. So, but to answer your question, yeah, there's a second album that I'm hoping will be sort of this idea of using a lot of her language in terms of living animals and creatures. She had a great love of nature, and I want to find a way to sort of translate that into following the narrative of this album. They'll be on distant planets and these sort of landing parties, finding odd and exotic animals and creating life and that kind of thing. And then the third album, which is already underway, is a kind of what I call a mixtape earth, and that'll just be a lot of funk and rock and some meditative songs, like those space people might have as a mixtape on their spaceship.
Yeah. Well, Brian Turner, poet and musician, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's brilliant. Thanks for having us here.
And Ben Kramer engineered and performed on the album as well. Ben, thank you too.
Thank you for having us.
And you're listening to a track called Light Sketch. It's by the Interplanetary Acoustic Team. It's off their new album. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Brenda Argetta. You can find us on the NPR One app. Download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.
Sometimes when I wake, I'm shaping the world with my hands.